It is nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT, broadcasting on 100.1 FM. It is your public radio station here in beautiful downtown Kodiak, Alaska, where it is partly, maybe mostly cloudy, 46 degrees. At the airport, they indicate they have east winds at 10 miles per hour and 10 miles of visibility. The Weather Service is predicting sunny skies today with a high near 48, west winds to 5, becoming completely calm later. Partly cloudy overnight tonight with a low of 34. Calm winds turning to the northwest to 5, and partly sunny skies tomorrow with a high near 45, calm winds becoming southeast to 5 in the afternoon. Rain is likely for Thursday night. Look for showers for Friday and Saturday, just a chance of showers on Sunday. Coming up on the Midday Report, aquaculture opportunity areas. What are they? That plus, Governor Dunleavy is leaning on lawmakers to approve his gas tax proposal.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The U.S. military is reporting it fired on an Iranian oil tanker today in the Gulf of Oman. Central Command saying the fighter jet was trying to breach the U.S. blockade on Iranian ports. The Trump administration maintains its ceasefire with Tehran is still holding, but President Trump is trying to pressure Iran to fully reopen the Strait of Hormuz, where disruptions to global shipments have caused an unprecedented energy crisis, including in the U.S., where polls show a growing number of people expressing frustration with the rising cost of gasoline, with the war, and with President Trump. Contrary to what industry analysts have projected, President Trump continues to promise relief will come quickly once the war is over. Today, he again said Iran's ready to strike a deal.
No, they want to make a deal badly, and we'll see if we get there. If we get there, they can't have nuclear weapons. You know, it's very simple.
With reports that the U.S. and Iran may be nearing a deal, world oil prices have fallen more than 7.5%. They're still above $101 a barrel. On Wall Street, the Dow rose more than 600 points, and other major U.S. market indices have closed up 1.3% to 2%. The war against Iran's causing some in the U.S. to change their travel plans. NPR's Stephen Basaha reports many travelers are avoiding international trips due to concerns about safety and cost.
James Ridgway just landed back home in D.C., but he might skip his trip to Europe after seeing the cost to fly.
We have tickets to see The Cure in Ireland, and I don't think we'll be able to swing it.
Arlene Hogan owns the travel advisor company Vacays for You, and she says her clients are sticking to domestic travel due to concerns about conflicts overseas. Hawaii is especially popular.
Even though Hawaii is an expensive destination when you think about it, however, it gives people a sense of security.
According to the travel site Kayak, international tickets in late April were up about $150 compared to a year earlier. Stephen Basaha, NPR News.
CNN founder Ted Turner has died at the age of 87. He was a consummate salesman who changed how much of the world consumes news. WABE's Molly Samuel has more.
Turner was a cable TV pioneer, founding TBS, CNN, Headline News, TNT, the Cartoon Network, and Turner Classic Movies. He gave $1 billion to the United Nations, creating the UN Foundation. And he was a co-founder of the Nuclear Threat Initiative, which seeks to rid the world of nuclear weapons. As one of the largest landowners in the country, Turner protected millions of acres of land on his ranches, while also bringing bison burgers to diners at his chain of Ted's Montana Grills. In 2018, Turner shared he had Lewy body dementia, a progressive brain disorder. He is survived by 5 children. For NPR News, I'm Molly Samuel in Atlanta.
This is NPR News.
Ang NPR Balita ay hatid sa inyo ng Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. Para sa kaukulang impormasyon tungkol sa aming mga serbisyo, tumawag lamang sa 481-2400.
For KMXT News, I'm Terry Haynes. 5 months after hiring an interim city manager, the city of Kodiak is still looking for someone to take on the gig permanently. But as KMXT's Davis Hovey reports, last week the city council put a temporary pause on the hiring process.
During a work session on April 28th, the council started reviewing the more than 15 applications it received for the city manager job so far. Some council members, like Bob Stanford, argued that at least one of the applicants could fit the bill.
I read every one of them. Well, it took a while. But, you know, I've got four names there. I checked. You know, these people could potentially be it.
But not all of the six council members saw it that way. Mayor Terry Haynes suggested the council hold off until Deputy City Manager Josie Banky returns from her time off later this month.
And the reason I put this out there that we should put a pause on the city manager search is that we just have too much on our plate right now. We have the boat harbor, we have the budget, and we have to fix those things. And this city manager search is just taking too much time, it's taking too much of our effort, and it's taking too much staff time.
For transparency, Haynes is also a KMXT employee. As KMXT's morning host, Haynes makes editorial decisions about what airs in local newscasts, but he did not edit or review the story before it was published. While the council is regrouping on the city manager recruitment process, Kodiak's interim manager Chris Laddick told the council it should update its offering package. Laddick, who is 5 months into his 9-month contract, says Kodiak is not matching up with other communities in rural Alaska that are also hunting for city managers.
I think you really need to look at what you're offering, because the other, you know, Ketchikan just hired their city manager. I think they have a listed starting salary at $223. They've got Naknek at $220 with a house, with a greenhouse, with a car.
The Bristol Bay manager job in Naknek that Laddick is referring to also comes with housing, a shop garage, and a sauna. Onalaska is hiring a city manager as well, with a salary of at least $210,000 annually, and offers city housing for rent. Currently, the Kodiak city manager job lists an annual salary of $175,000 with no housing option. By city code, the manager is also required to live within city limits, where housing options can be scarce. Resident Eileen Fitzgerald pointed out during the work session that these hiring challenges are not new ones.
Three times now, I have been told that the issues facing Kodiak make it uniquely difficult to fill this city manager position. The housing, the remoteness, the salary. So I just want to say, in those previous two cycles, those competing cities, I think, have found city managers.
Over the last 2 years, the city has had to start the hiring process for a new manager at least three separate times. The most recent hiring attempt came at the end of October, after Randy Robertson left the position after only being in the job for 7 weeks. By the end of the April 28th meeting, the council agreed to continue reviewing all the applications and consider updating the city manager job description and benefits package at the council's meeting on May 12th. Reporting in Kodiak, I'm Davis Hovey.
Interest in aquaculture is booming in Alaska, and the federal government is trying to help the industry grow by mapping out aquaculture opportunity areas, specific patches of the ocean where kelp and oyster farming is most likely to succeed. KMXT's Catherine Irving reports.
The Fisheries Department of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration is looking for input on their plan to identify these opportunity areas in the Gulf of Alaska. The designation won't change regulatory or permitting requirements, but NOAA's multi-year process generates a lot of environmental data, indigenous knowledge, and public input. Alicia Bishop is the regional aquaculture coordinator for NOAA Fisheries. She says that information can help both state regulators and potential farmers.
NOAA's role here is that we are trying to provide the best available information to help those managers make informed decisions and to also help future farmers find appropriate locations for farming.
Alicia Bishop is the regional aquaculture coordinator for NOAA Fisheries. She says that information can help both state regulators and potential farmers. A presidential executive order aimed at making American seafood more competitive kicked off the project at the national level in 2020. At the time, NOAA got more letters supporting starting the identification process in Alaska than any other region in the U.S. NOAA has already assessed the Gulf of Mexico and Southern California, where they identified 13 final areas across more than 21,000 acres. The scale in Alaska could be smaller in acreage, but broader in scope. NOAA is considering 77 potential spots across more than 13,000 acres in the Gulf of Alaska, from Ketchikan to Kodiak. Kodiak alone has 13 preliminary locations covering nearly 2,000 acres, which is the most of any other part of Alaska. Missy Good is a mariculture specialist based in Kodiak with Alaska Sea Grant. She says it's an ideal place to expand.
Kodiak in particular has a lot of upwelling, so we have a lot of nutrients available, so we can have really productive growth here. We don't have sea ice to contend with. We don't have the freshwater influences that you see in like Prince William Sound where you have glacial runoff.
And according to Bishop, Kodiak is the only place in Alaska where people have been asking NOAA to expand the study area. Over the past decade, Good says Kodiak has built a lot of infrastructure for aquaculture. The Shunack tribe received a $2.3 million grant last year. Good says they're using it to build a new kelp processing facility. Interest in the aquaculture market has ballooned not just in Kodiak, but across the state. NOAA says there's been a 400% increase in new farm applications to the state since 2016. Good says aquaculture pairs well with Alaska's existing industries.
Pristine waters, extensive coastlines, a workforce that is here and ready with similar skill sets with all of our commercial fisheries and processing infrastructure. Alaska's kind of an ideal spot.
Even though demand is growing for aquaculture farms in Alaska, Good says operations are still pretty small compared to heavy hitters in Asia. But she thinks aquaculture could one day be the solution to some of Alaska's problems.
A lot of coastal communities are looking for economic diversification. We're seeing fishery failures in different places, you know, and so it's like, what else can we do to maintain our livelihoods in the place that I want to live? Aquatic farming could be an answer to that.
Last month, NOAA opened a public comment period asking for scoping input on one of the final documents it will produce in the project, a programmatic environmental impact statement. NOAA will assess the potential impacts of putting aquaculture facilities in the areas they've identified, as well as the impact of conducting the assessment itself. NOAA is aiming to publish that final document in 2028. Alaskans can submit their comments online at regulations.gov. Bishop says her agency is looking for comments about how aquaculture affects local economies, social and cultural practices, marine ecosystems, and more. The comment period closes on May 28th. In Kodiak, I'm Catherine Irving.
Governor Mike Dunleavy is pressing lawmakers to act quickly on his proposal to cut taxes for the Alaska LNG project. Dunleavy says, with liquefied natural gas prices high and supplies uncertain because of the war with Iran, now is the moment for the $46 billion megaproject. At a news conference in Anchorage, Dunleavy called on lawmakers to pass a bill that, quote, is financeable, unquote. That is, a bill with a low enough tax rate to spur investment.
There's a lot of movement now in the energy world across the world. Many of our Asian allies and others are looking, where are we going to get energy on a long-term secure basis? Well, Alaska's secure. There's no doubt about it. But Alaska always also costs more.
The governor proposed a 6-cent tax on each unit of gas flowing through the pipeline from the North Slope to South Central Alaska. That would cut state tax revenue by about 90% when compared to the existing property tax. The current drafts of the House and Senate's gas pipeline tax bills have a much higher rate, 20 cents in the House and 55 cents in the Senate, plus additional expenses. Dunleavy says neither one is good enough to coax investors to buy in or lend to a high-cost, risky project. House lawmakers are working with the governor's office and pipeline developer Glenn Farne in refining their version of the bill. The House Resources Committee held a hearing yesterday working through various tweaks to their bill alongside Dunleavy's office and Glenn Farne. The bipartisan Senate Majority Caucus, on the other hand, is taking a more adversarial approach. Senators Kathy Geisel, an Anchorage Republican who chairs the Senate Resources Committee, says lawmakers aren't working with all the information they need, like the full cost of the project.
Really, if they want any kind of tax reduction, they need to help us with this bill, giving us actual numbers.
Giesel says the project could go forward even if lawmakers do nothing and leave the existing property tax in place. It has all the permits it needs, and an advisor to the governor told Giesel's committee yesterday morning that a higher tax rate would simply be passed on to consumers. But Glen Farne's Alaska head, Adam Prestige, says a high tax rate risks the project not going forward at all. Here he is talking about the Senate's tax rate.
I would describe that as very burdensome for the project, and potentially prohibitively so in terms of having a Phase 1 project go forward on any of the timelines that we've discussed.
Prestige says Glen Farne is open to some concessions not included in the governor's bill. He says the company has agreed to create so-called community impact funds to compensate for the costs of building the pipeline, to include a spur line to Fairbanks, and offer municipalities the opportunity to buy equity in the project. Dunleavy says if lawmakers don't pass something by the end of the session in 2 weeks, he's willing to call a special session to get it done. More than 6 months after the remnants of Typhoon Halong devastated western Alaska, impacted residents are still working to rebuild their homes and their lives. U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski held a roundtable in Anchorage yesterday with Interior Department officials to hear from community leaders from Kipnuk and Quiggillingok about challenges the communities still face and ideas on how to move forward. As Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early reports, thoughts of relocating the villages came up again and again.
When ex-Typhoon Halong blew through Quiggillingok last October, Lucy Martin sheltered in her home with her boys and her father.
Just after 2:15 a.m., I looked out the window and I saw graves rolling, graves and caskets rolling. It was a real life horror movie for me.
In Kipnuk, Village Chief Paul J. Paul says debris, sewage, and fuel contaminated the landscape as 16 family members, including 10 grandkids, holed up in his home.
Strong wind, heavy seas, waves starting to hit my house, peeled out my outer layer of plywood from my house.
Paul teared up, his voice cracking, as he spoke of his daughter asking them to sing Silent Night, hoping for some relief as the family prayed together. As roundtable attendees like Paul and Martin spoke, Billy Kirkland listened. Kirkland is Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs with the Department of Interior.
I don't want to say excited to be here, because obviously I'd much rather be here for a different situation, but we're happy to be a part of the process of healing that we have the ability to do.
Dustin Evan is Tribal Resilience Coordinator for Quiggillingok. He says before the storm hit, the village was already weighing the impacts of a warming climate, like thawing permafrost and increased river erosion.
Preliminary projections showed that Quig would be in great risk within 10 to 20 years. However, Typhoon Halong took care of that in one night. This will not be the only storm.
Martin works with Evan, and on a visit months after the storm, says she noticed patches of tundra had disappeared.
When I walk on raw ground, it's like walking on a waterbed. You're just on a jello pad. The land sunk even lower. Our land is no longer safe for year-round living.
Raina Paul, the tribal administrator for Kipnuk, says an additional issue is that the state is not communicating with tribes before sending contractors in for debris cleanup and other recovery efforts.
The state has been charging forward with hiring contractors to do work in our village without consultation. This violates our tribal sovereignty.
Problems for community members extend beyond their villages. Hundreds of Western Alaskans were relocated to larger cities like Anchorage after the storm. While tribal leaders expressed gratitude to the cities for taking them in, Martin says her community members are facing new challenges.
Our people are already struggling with housing. Our children are being bullied at schools. Many of our tribal members are struggling with mental health because of the trauma we went through. and we already lost 2 youth to suicide.
Others expressed concerns over a lack of access to traditional foods and subsistence hunting opportunities. Tribal members in both Quigilingok and Kipnuk have voted overwhelmingly to relocate to higher ground. But there are barriers, including costs, as well as varying jurisdiction over state, federal, and tribal land. Raina Paul says there's currently no clear pathway for relocation of this kind.
There is no current program for relocation and no agency that handles relocation and no source of funding for relocation. This forces relocating communities to try to navigate very complicated processes on their own.
She proposed a pilot project to set up an interim village in rural Alaska. She says the project should be funded and coordinated by multiple agencies in collaboration with tribes where both communities can rebuild.
Both Kipnuk and Quigilingok can come together. We can support each other, heal together, be a community again. This will help give us a sense of grounding that we desperately need.
Raina says she hopes such a pilot project would set a blueprint for wider federal relocation policy. Murkowski says a similar roundtable is scheduled for Wednesday in Bethel. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
May 5th was a day of awareness for missing and murdered Indigenous people. For many families, it's a reminder that cases are still open and may never close. Like Tracy Day's case. Day is a Tlingit woman from Juneau who went missing in 2019. Last year, Day's family requested a death declaration hearing as a way to ask police officers questions about their investigation. But the judge said their questioning wasn't allowed, even though it was allowed for the family of another Alaska Native woman who went missing. KTOO's Yvonne Crumry reports.
Tracy Day went missing in 2019. Ever since, her daughter, Kaylin Schneider, has been using TikTok and other avenues to draw attention to her case.
Imagine your mother disappears with absolutely no trace of what's happened to her, and the police...
Day was Tlingit, and her disappearance fits a broader pattern of Indigenous women who go missing or are killed at rates far higher than non-Indigenous women. Last year, Schneider petitioned the state to have her mother declared legally dead. For her, this was a chance to prod Juneau police officials publicly about the investigation into Day's disappearance to finally get answers. Hear Schneider during the presumptive death hearing.
I was hoping to ask JPD a few questions. I didn't realize that I wasn't going to get that chance. I had some questions that I felt were important to the case, but...
Judge Peggy McCoy did not allow her to ask them.
Well, this is not about the investigation.
Right,
it's about whether they believe she's still alive.
After the hearing that legally declared her mother dead, Schneider told KTOO in the courthouse she'd spent weeks preparing for the chance to ask officers questions.
We don't care about a death certificate. We just wanted to tell her story in a legal setting and make JPD answer our questions. That's what this was about.
Schneider was not off base to think she'd be allowed to question police officers. She had reason to think this. 1 year earlier, at another presumptive death declaration hearing in Anchorage for a different missing Alaska Native woman, the woman's family was able to question police officers about their investigation. The woman's name was Cassandra Boskovsky. She went missing in Anchorage in 2019, just months after Tracy Day disappeared in Juneau. 5 years later, with prompting by MMIP advocates, Anchorage police connected a photo of a woman found on the phone of serial killer Brian Stephen Smith with Boskovsky's missing persons case. Boskovsky's death declaration was a result of this information, that she was likely killed by Smith. The judge at the Boskovsky hearing allowed the family to interview police officers about the investigation in front of a jury. Here's Judge Brian Clark talking to Boskovsky's cousin, Marcella Boskovsky Grounds, in a recording of the 2024 hearing.
Ms. Boskovsky Grounds, are there any other questions that you think this witness should talk about before we ask the jurors?
Judge Clark also allowed family members to read testimony they prepared and said information the family and advocates brought to the hearing was admissible.
Like I said, this is not an adversarial proceeding. Nobody is going to object to that.
Now, more than a year after the hearing, Boskovsky Grounds said the experience was empowering and intense.
It was relieving in a sense. Heart-wrenching. I had all kinds of mixed emotions going on at that time.
She suspects that nationwide media coverage on Brian Stephen Smith was part of the reason the courts gave her family so much power during the hearing. Tracy Day's family, however, wasn't given the same opportunity. Now, nearly a year later, Kaylin Schneider says the hearing is still a painful memory.
I actually stopped talking about it for a while because I was so just deeply traumatized by the situation.
For Schneider, the presumptive death declaration was a Hail Mary, a chance to get JPD to reinvestigate the case.
For a while, I was feeling pretty hopeless about it. It was really hard because I felt like that was our last ditch effort. You know, we had nothing. We had no body, no proof that a crime occurred.
She says it was important to her to ask JPD questions about the investigation into her mother's disappearance in front of a public audience. She saw social media posts by other MMIP advocates who said these hearings were a way to question investigators.
It was like, oh my God, this is genius because it's a legal loophole where we can force them to be in a courtroom answering these questions and they can't just like say no.
Ann Schneider still wants the answers to the questions she prepared to ask JPD at the hearing.
I really just want to know, like, who they looked into, what evidence they have, and if they plan on doing anything or if they're just going to leave it open and unattended by an investigator.
Juneau police say they will investigate new leads as they come in, and they're reevaluating their procedures for communicating with families of missing people. A spokesperson from the Alaska Department of Law said that aside from brief guidelines, it's up to the judge how witness testimony will be presented in death declaration hearings. In Juneau, I'm Yvonne Cromery.
Today's KMXT local news is brought to you in part by Discover Kodiak, a one-stop source for visitor information on Kodiak and other destinations around the state. On the web at kodiak.org and at the Visitor Center in the Ferry Terminal Building at 100 Marine Way, 486-4782.
A comfortable home starts with the right heating setup, and many Alaskans are turning to heat pumps. Households from Metlakatla to Kodiak could be eligible for heat pump installation assistance through the Accelerating Clean Energy Savings Program. More information is available at akheatsmart.org. This message is supported by a grant from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's Climate Pollution Reduction Grants. ACES comes to you courtesy of Southeast Conference, Alaska Heat Smart, and the Alaska Municipal League.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Wednesday. It is the 6th day of May, the year 2026. The sun rose today at 6:05. It will set again at 10:08. That will give us 16 hours and 3 minutes of glorious daylight, a gain of 4 minutes and 29 seconds compared to yesterday. Our record high temperature for this date was 69 degrees, set in 2004, and our record low was 26, set in 1920. It is currently 46 degrees in Kodiak with mostly to partly cloudy skies. The Weather Service is calling for completely sunny skies at some point today with a high near 48, west winds to 5, becoming completely calm this afternoon. For tonight, partly cloudy skies, low of 34, calm winds turning to the northwest to 5 or so, and partly sunny skies tomorrow with a high near 45, calm winds turning to the southeast to 5 or so in the afternoon. Look for showers for Saturday, for Friday, Saturday, Sunday, just a chance of showers. We just had a low tide. Our next high tide will be at 6:20 p.m. Here on the east side and be 5.8 feet. Followed by a low tide at 11:13 p.m. of 3.5 feet. Over on the west side, your high tide will happen at 6:30 p.m. and be 10.3 feet in Larsen Bay, followed by a low tide at 11:49 p.m. of 5.3 feet. Mariners, here's your weather forecast for Marmot Island to Sitkanak out to 15 miles, west winds to 20 knots, becoming west 15 tonight, 6-foot seas, subsiding to 4 feet tonight. For tomorrow, variable 10, becoming northeast 20 Thursday night, 3-foot seas, building to 4 feet Thursday night. And for Friday, northeast 20 and 7-foot seas on our east side. Over on the Shelikof Strait, west 20, becoming southwest 15 tonight, 5-foot seas, subsiding to 4 feet tonight. For tomorrow, variable 10 becoming northeast 20 Thursday night, 3-foot seas building to 5 feet on Thursday night in the Shelikof. The Kodiak Public Library Association will be having their board meeting tonight. That's happening at 5:30 p.m. through 7 p.m. at the Kodiak Public Library's multipurpose room. The Kodiak City Council will be having a budget work session on Thursday in the City Hall's conference room. That meeting will begin at 5:30 p.m. It is open to the public, and it will be web-streamed. The link for that and the meeting packet is available at the City of Kodiak's website. For more information, contact the city clerk at 907-486-8636. And this year's commencement is happening this Friday at 7 p.m. at the Gerald C. Wilson Auditorium. Help them celebrate an incredible group of graduates who truly reflect the heart, grit, and resilience of our island community. Again, that ceremony begins at 7 p.m. Everyone is welcome, and that's at the Gerald C. Wilson Auditorium.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 3 times a day. Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the Midday Report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.